Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to The Corbett Report. I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com with a Solutions Watch for you. And this is an interesting Solutions Watch because it's one that's going to concentrate on some good things that are already actually happening in the real world, rather than talking about the bad things and how we might mitigate them. What am I referring to? Well, I'm referring to something that I talked about with today's guest just about 6 weeks ago. I was talking to Mark Morano of ClimateDepot.com about the COP flop in Brazil. And at that time, we were talking about things that may or may not be coming up. For example, the World Economic Forum annual meeting in Davos that Mark Morano was attending this year. And we were also talking about, well, Mark Morano made the plea once again, or reiterated his plea, Mr. President, please get the United States out of the UNFCCC/IPCC. And you know what? It happened. Can you believe it? Yes. And we can take this from ClimateDepot.com. Victory as Trump withdraws America from UN Climate Framework and UNIPCC. Wow. Some good news for a change. And here to tell us about that good news and what it really means is the aforementioned Mark Morano. Mark, thank you once again for joining us.
Thank you, James. Happy to be here. Yes, and it is very good news on that, because that wasn't even on any president's, you know, wish list until this happened. And it wasn't, Trump's first term didn't even consider this. So it's a huge deal. It was the granddaddy of them all, the 1992 treaty. I say it's like a Jenga block. This is pulling out the foundation from the whole UN hold on America.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. But I think my regular listeners will probably have some idea how momentous an event this is. But there's always new people tuning in. So for the benefit of those people, why don't you set the background a little bit? What was the IPCC? How was it constructed? And what does this withdrawal actually mean?
Sure. Okay. Well, there's multiple components to this. First of all, the IPCC was actually a action where he's withdrawing the U.S. from that, which means we're no longer going to fund the UNIPCC, which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. This was formed actually back in 1988, and then they had their first report in 1990. Now, these reports, the actual underlying scientific reports, are just a synthesis report. But they have a thing called the Summary for Policymakers. And beginning in the 1995-96 report, we were able to document that the UN scientists literally changed the wording of the scientific summary for policymakers so that it would sound alarming. They issued a first draft. It wasn't alarming. Then we actually know who got involved. Sweden, I think it was Norwegian scientists, went in and changed wording, and all these activist scientists to say, you know, that, you know, we were convinced and the evidence is clear and incontrovertible. And what ended up happening is they had a chart in 1990 showing the medieval warm period, much warmer than today. And we actually had a senator at the U.S. Senate Environment Public Works Committee when I worked there back when Senator Inhofe was the chairman. He was this Republican from Oklahoma, the only senator willing to stand up to the global warming, you know, con back then. And there was other senators that later joined him. But we actually had scientists testify saying that UN scientists were so unhappy that they showed the medieval warm period warmer that, quote, we have to get rid of the medieval warm period. And lo and behold, by the 2001 report, they had gotten rid of it. So it's like an accounting firm. You're losing money for, you know, say 15 years. You hire a new accountant and they redo the books and show that you have record profits. That's essentially what the UNIPCC was guilty of doing. And then, of course, all sorts of, you know, investigations went into that. We had Canadians, Ross McKittrick and Steve McIntyre, and we had a whole series of scientists. And it was just fraud, basically, pure and simple, that they had gone back and mixed and matched different proxy data. And they had had a temperature reconstruction to show that temperatures were here and then a huge jump. Anyway, this was later almost not necessarily dropped, but de-emphasized from the IPCC. And they don't really talk about it as much anymore because there's been so much, you know, scandal and problems with it. But that has been the basis when you hear of the world's top scientists, the experts, 97%, often people are referring to the UN scientists. And so people understand these are handpicked scientists by activist governments who want to get money and funding out of the United Nations. If you dissent, and we have, and I did a whole report on this when I was in the Senate, scientists from Richard Lindzen to John Christie to the hurricane
experts.
Judith Curry wasn't actually involved directly in the IPCC, but she was kicked out of the tribe. She was called a heretic. But essentially what happened was anyone who dissented, you were, you know, made very uncomfortable and you left. And then they all explained why they left. And so it was basically scientists who would only toe the line. That's how the UN IPCC works. So Donald Trump's pulling out the U.S. of that, and what the head of it now, the current head of the IPCC, said he doesn't see how the organization can continue without U.S. funding and U.S. presence, because we were like the person behind it. Now, separately, but in conjunction with that, the 1992 Rio Earth Summit Treaty, and this is actually the bigger news, because it's horrible that we funded all these. And I'd be at UN. I was in Bali. I was in Kenya, Africa. I've been to 22 out of the last 24 of these. And it was so sad under Republican George Bush and even under Donald Trump's first administration, we would be rubber stamping, funding, and supporting these reports. And essentially, we'd be saying, oh, well, we can't do a deal because China won't be involved. So we'd come up with reasons like that. Well, the difference in Trump 2.0 is he's basically saying, it's a hoax. It's a scam. It's a con. Lee Zeldin is EPA chief, who I didn't have much hope for. I'm really surprised by most consequential EPA chief. He's come in and reframed the narrative. He's come in and just dismantled. Chris Wright, energy secretary, has been doing a great job. Donald Trump at this point has done 250 actions, many of them now followed up by Congress. I would say for those of you unhappy with Donald Trump, and I know there's a lot, you know, even people think ICE is too heavy handed. They don't like Palantir. They don't like his foreign policy.
Epstein.
The one area, what's that?
Epstein.
And of course, Epstein. That's the big one. The one area where I think it's almost pure and it's actually almost exceeded his promises is climate and energy. I am in stunned disbelief. And I'm with a group of like 30 climate skeptic groups, 30 people in a group that represents about a dozen organizations. And we had a top 10 list for Trump to do. He blew through that like in the first month. Then we came up with that list. He blew through that. We got to a point where we were trying to come up with more things that he could do. Not saying they're all going to be successful, but he's maxed out everything he can do. And some of these are going to be long court cases. One of the things I had argued in his first term is they needed to do a U.S. government report. No government's ever done it, countering the UN IPCC. Well, they actually did it. The energy secretary, Chris Wright, commissioned a report. Judith Curry, Steve Koonin, climatologist John Christie, and Ross McKittrick, statistician. I mean, it was an incredible report. The first ever government report anywhere in the world to push back. And what happened? Well, and then the EPA is using that as a basis to get rid of the CO2 endangerment finding, which they may or may not be successful, but they're trying and they're openly going after it. What happened was that environmentalists sued the Trump administration. It turns out one of the scientists didn't fill out a form correctly. And ergo, the whole report was by a federal judge invalidated. And now the report had to be pulled off the website. So, you know, it sounds like it was just an error of lack of competence and not following through, but at least they tried on that part. But at least we had the report, but it's no longer, you know, available on the government. It still exists, but it's not an official government report from what I understand. Anyway, just to sum this up, pulling out of this 1992 framework, this was May of 1992, George H.W. Bush was facing a re-election against Bill Clinton as the challenger and Ross Perot. And by the way, Ross Perot pulled out because he said his daughter's wedding was threatened. And I thought, oh, what a kook. After everything I've learned in the last 35 years, I 100% believe deep state actors contacted Ross Perot, his daughter, her fiance, and scared the living shit out of him. And that's why he pulled out of that race. I thought he was just exaggerating, a kook at the time. It's amazing how you can look back at history and say, you know, 100%, and we know exactly what happened there. They were terrified of Ross Perot, just in general, because he was outside the two-party system, even though his views weren't radical. Anyway, I digress. So George Bush goes down to Rio. He had a chief of staff named John Sununu, who was seen as a big conservative. And he assured everyone, don't worry, we're not going to sign a binding treaty, blah, blah, blah. It was all politics in the Republican administration's mind, right? They sign on to this UN Convention Framework on Climate Change. This introduces in America, and it gets ratified by the U.S. Senate same year. This introduces in the U.S. Senate, I'm sorry, in the United States, Sustainable Development Agenda 21, eventually of Agenda 2030. This introduces the entire climate process, the annual climate summits all over the world. This introduces the climate treaties, the UN Paris Agreement, the Copenhagen Agreement, all of the net zero. This was the brainchild, the foundation for all of that. And I had been reading all year about environmentalists terrified that they were going to, the Trump administration would do this. Why? Because according to the way it's written, now we both know that we live essentially in a lawless land at this point, and law doesn't mean anything, but in a normal world, let's start with that premise. If you pull out of that treaty that was ratified and the president pulls out and it's part of his provision, it takes, by the way, a year. We're not officially out of it until probably January 2027 by the statute. If you pull out, in order to get back in, a future president, AOC or Gavin Newsom, they're going to have to resubmit it to the Senate for ratification. That's the line. But having said that, we already know the environmental lawsuit and a federal judge invalidated this great federal climate report. We already know that you can pretty much pick a judge and you never know what the Supreme Court. So in theory, this is incredibly semi-permanent and really does consequential, makes it much harder to get us back in. In reality, you never know. I don't trust the court system and I don't trust our laws and all that. So, but it's still a huge advance. And it was amazing that he did it. And the next on the agenda is he's going to be going after the CO2 endangerment finding, which is an absurdity. A Clean Air Act originally passed in 1990. Then there was a update. I think it was, if I got the read, like 2007 maybe. And never mentioned carbon dioxide. What had nothing to do with carbon dioxide. And essentially, they retroactively went back through the Obama EPA and the Supreme Court allowed it that you could regulate carbon dioxide as a pollutant under the Clean Air Act. Now, carbon dioxide, we inhale oxygen, we exhale carbon dioxide. So the federal government, unelected bureaucrats without a vote of Congress, can now regulate human breath. And don't think that's far-fetched, because there's been a peer-reviewed study out of England saying that human breath has warming agents, and I think it was Africans have less warming agents than Asians, and women have more warming agents than men. They actually broke it down by identity politics. So if they can get rid of this CO2 endangerment finding and invalidate it so that a future president, Gavin Newsom, can't do that again, because this is why you don't have a vote in. This is why since 2009 was the last actual vote on climate bill, so to speak, besides pork barrel spending. I'm talking about an actual climate bill, the cap and trade. And the reason that was the last bill is because they lost and they said, we don't need no stinking democracy. They decided to bypass it. I called it the Chinification of America, where they go and now everything's just done through the middle bureaucracy and courts. And you don't have to, because last thing they want is a vote in Congress on anything related to climate, where you're going to have switchboards lighting up and people claiming, we need this bill. They did this in 2009. We need this because the hurricanes and tornadoes are worse. So anyway, that's what Trump has done. It has been unbelievable. And I'm not happy with Trump. As I mentioned, I don't like him funding AI, $100 million Pentagon contracts. I don't like him usurping state rights with the AI, not allowing states to regulate him. I don't like him giving Palantir all that money, which was originally a Bush Cheney brainchild type concept. I don't like him removing Venezuelan dictator. I don't like him bombing Iran. I don't like how long it's taken to end the Ukraine war. I don't like him increasing the Pentagon budget $1.5 trillion after saying he was going to cut it to $500 million. You can see the quotes early in his administration. I don't like the whole Epstein disaster, the obvious, that was clear. I believe Marjorie Taylor Greene when she said he wanted it not to come out because a lot of his friends would be hurt by it at the very least. So there's a lot of people very upset that think, but on these issues, I can't find anything to fault. He's exceeded on climate and energy. Particular. So
exactly right. So you've been talking about this for decades. I've been covering this on the Corbett Report for nearly two decades. This is a momentous and incredible thing. But I guess there is another argument to be made. I'm sure you saw just a few days ago in the Washington Post, there was an op-ed from Bjorn Lomborg, who says how Trump can buy some global climate sanity for less than $2 million, arguing that the IPCC has actually been the institution, the world's most effective bulwark against climate alarmism.
I have to be careful here, because I don't like to do, I've always respected Bjorn Lomborg and loved his early work especially, but he's been known as a lukewarmer. He's a guy that comes out, and I'm going to tell you a couple facts about him, but he's a guy that comes out and says climate is a real serious problem, but these solutions are no good, and this is not the way to solve it. And he appeals to, you know, the sort of the establishment skeptics and people who want to be safe. So he was always, he would get conference meetings at more mainstream groups. He would get TV interviews. So he's always done that. What's come out recently, a couple surprising things. Bill Gates, and I think we talked about this last time I was on, flipped his climate view, essentially. He now says climate is not a catastrophe, that humans aren't in threat, and that we need human flourishing. He actually used that phrase. And that was a shock, but it really wasn't, because his whole business model now is pushing AI. And we already know Larry Fink of BlackRock said solar and wind can't possibly power AI. We had recently at Davos other CEOs stepping forward, I think it was Honeywell CEO, stepping forward saying basically the exact same thing, that solar and wind are just not in the conversation. He actually said you can't change physics. Like, it's not going to happen. It's just not even in the table, in the cards. So Beyond Lomberg, it turns out, and I just found this out within the last 2 months, is funded by Bill Gates. Beyond Lomberg is getting Bill Gates money. And I noticed earlier in 2025 that he was pushing, like, oh, we shouldn't be spending money on climate. If we were spending money on vaccines in Africa, that would be much better. And then I'd be reading the comment section when Beyond Lomberg said that. And it was just person after person. Why would we be giving them these vaccines? What benefit is that? Who are these vaccines? And Lomberg never replied. Turns out he's being funded by Bill Gates. And secondly, he's in the Epstein files as wanting to meet with Jeffrey Epstein. He's on Jeffrey Epstein's schedule. And it was also Bill Gates was in there. So I'm assuming that he's had a long-term funding, a relationship with Bill Gates, and that Bill Gates was looking for maybe a way out of the, you know, his climate mess. And as I mentioned, he's very lukewarm, if you will, his position. So it's a good way for Bill Gates to position to Beyond Lomberg. But that's another thing that's happened, is he's in the last couple of days, the Epstein file, as on Jeffrey Epstein's schedule. The only reason Beyond Lomberg would meet with Epstein that I can think of is for funding. But I don't know the details. It was met him with New York. He didn't go to his island or anything. So anyway, that was an interesting angle as well. And I don't know, you know, I've only met Beyond Lomberg a couple times, and I have no ill will toward him. He's been an incredibly effective spokesman. I don't want to sit here and trash him, but I'm just saying that's a pretty big deal when you're funded by Bill Gates and you also are meeting with Jeffrey Epstein.
Absolutely. And that probably revolves around some of the other things that I'd like to talk about.
Well, I didn't even mention. Yeah, he's also, and that brings me to premise your question. He's defending the IPCC, yeah, which is, you know, maybe something Bill Gates wants. I don't know, but that's just crazy to have just keep in mind, the UN was started in 1988, this IPCC panel, with the goal of finding how CO2 is going, yeah, to harm the climate. If it fails to find CO2 is driving a climate catastrophe, it fails to have a reason to exist, number one. And number two, it fails to have a reason to promote the climate summits that they have and to come up with solutions. Yeah. So it's a self-serving lobbying organization. It's de facto absurd on the face of it. I don't know how Beyond Lomberg or anyone who cares about science could actually defend the IPCC.
I agree completely. He says summarizing the underlying science, which remains largely unalarming, it has restrained extreme narratives. But that's demonstrably untrue, because, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't the Michael Mann's hockey stick popularized by being on the front cover of, yes, was it the first IPCC report?
No, it was the third IPCC report,
third, right,
2001. Yeah, remember the, yeah, first one had the reverse hockey stick,
right,
the medieval,
yes, right. Yeah.
Yeah. So then they, yeah, said we had to get rid of the medieval. We had scientists testifying, and we know the names of the UN scientists. We have to get rid of. And by the way, they're doing the same thing right now. Andrew Dessler of Texas A&E University is a climate alarmist scientist. He's openly saying we have to get rid of the 1930s heat wave. If you look at even Obama and Biden's EPA, the 1930s were the hottest decade by almost a factor of 10. And the U.S. has actually cooled by the heat wave index. We now have scientists openly saying we have to get rid of the 1930s heat wave. And when the EPA under Biden shows U.S. heat waves to show their worst, they pick the 1960s, one of the coldest periods of the database, to show them increasing. And they completely ignored the much higher 1930s. So there's, it's this is the reason you, to much extent as possible, you do not want these kind of organizations, lobbying interests, political interests, messing with science. And it's horrific for anyone to defend the IPCC.
Absolutely right. It's an important edifice, as you say, an important Jenga block in the Jenga tower of the globalist edifice.
That's the 1992 treaty. So we're pulled out of that, takes a year. And that is huge, because if it does require ratification, that's a big deal. So sorry, I think we cleared all that up. A little bit long-winded here, but go ahead.
And I think it's an important part of a larger puzzle. And to switch analogies here, maybe it's the domino and one of the next blocks to fall. Who knows? Maybe the United Nations itself. This from AP just this past week. United Nations faces imminent financial collapse without urgent action, UN chief says. Oh, boo-hoo. I certainly hope that Trump and the U.S. administration can come in with billions of dollars for the U.N. Maybe not, but it may just be a part of the sort of larger collapse that's happening. And to get a sense of that, let's talk about your time in Davos. And I'll point people to a post you had up on Climate Depot. The Great Reject? World Economic Forum chief Larry Fink admits the forum is no longer trusted, calls the WEF elites in an age of populism. Mark, what did you see in Davos this year?
Yeah. So, well, first of all, I attended a counter Davos event, the World Prosperity Forum, where I actually gave a 30-minute speech, and I went through and I wrote the book, The Great Reset, Global Elites and the Permanent Lockdown. So what happened this year was amazing. It was my first time actually attending in person. And if you go back, this was started in early 1970s by Klaus Schwab. He has been ousted from the organization, which obviously they wanted him gone as the face of the organization post-COVID. And with climate dropping, they just saw no reason. And all the exposure they got, I think the Great Reset backfired publicity-wise for them. So they came up with the most trumped-up charges. You know, the idea is, oh, he was a lavish spending in hotels. And like it was like just absurd stuff. And then he's forced to step down. He actually showed up in video clips, sort of bitter at his home, not far from Davos, not invited either. But so that's part of what happened. But I think what's happened this year, Donald Trump hijacked the entire agenda with his Greenland. I almost said nonsense, but I guess it was Greenland nonsense. It was all sort of political, you know, gamesmanship. He had the entire conference hijacked by Donald Trump. Is he going to seize Greenland or is he not? To the point where you had like Emmanuel Macron and other Western European leaders wanting to do an intervention with Donald Trump. And it raised the specter of, you know, like sitting him down, bringing in his second grade teacher and having a car ready to go to take him to rehab or something. But they were so upset about that, the entire conference was overshadowed. But having said, of course, Trump showed up and then backed off on that. But what was most significant is they did a pre-survey of the World Economic Forum members, and climate had dropped significantly from a top item agenda down to very low. And that's because of A, the public backlash. Remember, we've endured years now of EU farmers in the Netherlands spread throughout Europe protesting the net zero agricultural policies. We've witnessed what happened in Sri Lanka. We've seen elections in Germany turn more climate skeptic. We're seeing the rise in Britain of hopefully a climate skeptic party with Nigel Farage getting all the votes. We're seeing it throughout Europe. And even then, the EU elections last year, I was in Vienna, Austria. I guess this is 2024 now. Huge gains for people oppose the agenda. Of course, the way the EU is structured, it doesn't really matter how you vote. It's this top level bureaucracy that's in charge of it all, and they can do whatever the hell they want and usually do. But at some point, they are accountable to the masses, as they would call us. But one of the great highlights, of course, was the Netherlands farmers spraying manure on the headquarters of the EU. And I've been there, and there's no building in the world that's more deserving of having manure sprayed all over the fun of it. Having said that, so the climate issue dropped in attendance. Even Larry Fink was sort of down on it. Larry Fink, of course, now is the co-chair of the World Economic Forum, of the You Will Own Nothing and Be Happy. Larry Fink, who Trump administration is tepidly trying to stop things like Blackstone and BlackRock, other equity asset from buying up, you know, U.S. homes or farmland. We'll see how far that goes. I have a feeling it's going to be more on a paper law than actual teeth. But essentially, this meeting, climate was just shoved completely to the side. Now, just keep in mind, 5 years ago, they were so excited in 2020, June. That's when this whole, I mean, Great Reset had existed since 2014, the phrase. But that's when Klaus Schwab did that essay combining climate change with the pandemic of COVID-19. And they were going to have the Great Reset, and they were going to merge these two. Remember, unchecked climate leads to more, you know, viruses. And we had to, these were something we could fight together, and it morphed into Build Back Better. And every world leader was on cue and repeating the same lines. And then, of course, the videos came out. You will own nothing and be happy, and meat will be a rare treat, and we'll be eating all this other stuff. Everything will be delivered to you by drones in your house. You'll have no privacy, but it'll be just fine. These are all things that came directly out of the World Economic Forum. And years went by with the entire world ridiculing and trashing, and to the point where they pulled the video, the World Economic pulled the video of, you'll own nothing, be happy. Anyway, all of that comes. Donald Trump's elected. This was the first meeting he's attended in person in his second term. And they had just, they like basically got climate and tossed it under the bed, threw some blankets on top, stuffed it in there, and didn't want to talk about it or see it. The only person who showed up in Davos talking climate that I'm aware of, I mean, other than maybe a mention here, there's Al Gore. Al Gore talked to Bloomberg News right before he got there. He was very upset. He did this just his usual speech about climate's going to cause millions of refugees. Blah, blah. It was like the same speech he could have given in 2005, 2010, 2015, 2020. No difference. He doesn't read the room. In other words, he hasn't adjusted his messaging. He just thinks like there's a climate emergency and everyone's with us. And there's a few deniers that are funded by the oil industry. And that's the only reason you wouldn't believe him. And he shows up and guess what Al Gore is reduced to at a World Economic Forum meeting, unprecedented. Keep in mind, he showed up in Brazil attacking Bill Gates because Bill Gates was acting, quote, silly for saying climate isn't a catastrophe. And he said Bill Gates was just being bullied, implying he was a nerd being bullied by the cool kid, Donald Trump. Well, he shows up at Davos in person, and the only news he gets, I'm not making this up, you've probably seen it, is heckling a speaker at the Davos Forum, and it happened to be Trump's Commerce Secretary, Howard Lutnick. And there's video of it, and Lutnick actually addressed Gore. Gore is shouting, boo, boo, you know, because Lutnick is derailing on net zero. But that's the only news Al Gore got out of Davos as a heckler. That just shows you how far everything has shifted. I went to the climate hub at there. Now, first of all, they had a car that looked like a size of a lawnmower with a roof on it and, you know, a windshield and all that. And it said this was essentially the car of the future. And it was the Eco Hub car. And it was like their big thing, like this little courtyard. And then they had a building, but it was very low key still. Meanwhile, you walk around the streets, there were Mercedes, BMWs, sports cars. I mean, this was Davos. And I've been to, as a journalist, to conferences in Aspen and Vail. And I say as a journalist just because I couldn't afford those places otherwise, but I went as a journalist to cover this. One was a conference and one was a story about endangered species. But I get the same exact vibes. This is the uber wealthy of Europe. And the chalets looked incredible. The restaurants were high end. The buildings, everything about the place was just reeked of money. And they're promoting this little Eco Hub car. This was obviously a sort of a holdover. So I go into one of their functions. They had an event at 2 o'clock in this dark theater. And it was a speech about the, this is how they're going stealth now. Financialization of nature. It was a whole panel of four academics, mid-level bureaucrats, as boring and unquotable as you can imagine. So there's no media coverage of this, and there was no media coverage of it. I sat in there for about a half hour, and they were talking about assigning financial, a value to every lake, stream, forest, natural asset across the world. And essentially the banking industry through coordination with international bodies like the United Nations would be assigning like an ESG type score to these bodies. And the idea would be you can't develop your land. You don't have absolute property rights until you compensate the earth. And that's compensated through these banks. And there's also a movement, of course, in the U.S. where, you know, environmentalists are suing on behalf of a river if someone goes to dam it, or a forest if someone wants to harvest it or cut trees down. They're, you know, essentially natural, they're nature's rights. So this was very much in line with that. This was boring, bureaucratic, legalese. And this is the kind of thing I think they want to move into. They're laying low. They're looking at this sort of as a kidney stone, the climate skepticism, the rejection of their agenda. And they're hoping it passes with the minimal amount of blood and they can go on. But essentially, the meeting had nothing to do with climate. No one talked about it. They, to the extent they did, it was stealth or absurd, like the car. The only climate activist was booing speakers, Al Gore. And Donald Trump showed up. I got to go into the American Pavilion. I got to meet Nigel Farage, and I got to hang out in the, you know, like the green room where all the other Americans. That was a lot of fun the day that Trump spoke. But I didn't get to see Trump in person, but he, I think, just reveled in the idea of calling basically, you know, basically reiterated climate was a scam, net zero. He talked about how, I love how he makes it so personal that you all in this room, you couldn't have been wrong or you were wrong about this. He pounded it. He had Commerce Secretary Lutnick gave a great speech. Now, again, how much they mean it, if you look at Lutnick's history, if you look at Scott Bessent's history being with Soros, I'm not naive. They're talking a great game, and some of their policies are very good, particularly on this issue. But he told the World Economic Forum that, you know, Europe was incredibly dumb, that they seeded out their entire net zero. They went with the net zero agenda, and they, when they don't even make their own battery, they're relying completely on China. Like, he made it like an IQ level thing, and it was incredible just how devastating some of the speeches were. Even if I know a lot in your audience, and I saw some of the comments last time, you know, like, oh, I'm the Fox News guy, blah, blah. I know that people don't believe it, but, you know, at least they're talking, and the words you can't take back. I'm a big believer in narrative. Like, look at the words on it, Jeffrey Epstein. In other words, they said they were going to release the files. They were now, I don't know how much, it's only, you know, about half have been released, and they're heavily redacted. They're protecting a lot of stuff still. But words have power because it forces their hand. So it's very hard to take back some of these words, like when you have the EPA calling climate a scam or religion a cult, when you have people saying you have to release the Epstein files, and then they're forced to by congressional vote, even if it takes just, you know, Thomas Massie and a couple other congressmen. By the way, that's my biggest offense with Donald Trump, I think, at the moment, is that he would call Thomas Massie a rhino. He would call Thomas Massie a liberal or votes with them. Insane. If I was ever interested in going back on Capitol Hill, I would have worked for two people, Marjorie Taylor Greene or Thomas Massie. There's no one else at this point I would have worked for on Capitol Hill. And I have a secret hope that Ted Cruz can actually somehow lose his election if he's running for Senate again, just to, you know, he's sort of running as the uniparty Republican. Anyway, none of that's relevant. I'm just saying that words mean something. So I know there's a lot of skepticism about the Trump administration, and I understand it. I think he's squandered probably the greatest populist movement in my lifetime, 50 plus years. I don't think that we're going to see that alignment come together with all the people. And I think not on climate, though. On climate and energy, he's kept his word, and it's been phenomenal.
Well, I couldn't agree with that assessment more. And I have noted in my work that people love to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory and look for the dark lining on every silver cloud and everything else. People hate to hear a good news or progress that has been made on anything because, unfortunately,
bad news. Yeah, permanent. Yeah,
exactly. Bad news sells, and people want to hear that. But having said that, let's be realistic about this. Of course, this doesn't mean you're retiring. This doesn't mean mission accomplished, Mark Morano's life work is over, and you can go retire on some island somewhere and enjoy the rest of your life. I'm assuming, you know, there's still going to be pushback. The globalists are not dead yet. So what should we be prepared for? What are they working on? How do we prepare for that?
Well, their big push is AI. So that's their focus. It just seems like that's obsessed with everything. Remember, Yuval Harari, World Economic Forum, Davos contributor, actually said, that we're useless eaters and AI will take the jobs, and we need psychotropic drugs and video games to occupy the masses, essentially. So that's going to be one of their big things. And they're going after, they want surveillance. They want, and they want just massive AI. They want taxpayer subsidies for that. By the way, when I read, I'm in Virginia, the state with the most data centers. They look like Soviet style, ugly building, windowless, like a Soviet architect from the 1950s is designing them all. Blight on the landscape. And I'm convinced in 10 years, technology will advance that they're going to be abandoning all these data centers. They're going to be left with these big concrete halls sitting on the side of the road everywhere. But essentially, they're going to move. AI is a big part of it. Climate is going to go stealth. Climate is going to go into sort of a merging with public health. The World Health Organization is working. We already have doctors' toolkits. They already want to put it as the death certificate. They're naming these winter, the big snowstorm we had. I'm in Washington, D.C. We've had record cold, almost 100-year cold. We had an unbelievable storm. I love driving. I have a Jeep with locking axles. This was the most unbelievable snowstorm we had in terms of ice and traction. And anyway, my point being is that, I don't know what my point was about the snowstorm, but anyway, I lost my train of thought there. But the goal at this point the point I was making is they're seizing on that. They're still the same people going along. BBC, all these other studies coming out saying the record cold, snow, these are all the symptoms of global warming. They're caused by global warming. They're still pushing all that. And this whole thing has been funded for decades, obviously. So you still have the Richard Branson money, Bill Gates money, all academia, corporate America. You have all the education going on. And so it's not going to just disappear. Throughout history, the ruling class, governing elite have tried to come up with reasons why the rest of us cannot be free. And I think, right now, it's probably, illegal immigrants and, you have mass federal agents, which in my lifetime, I never would have thought fellow conservatives would be supportive. Family members, people support it. I think it's great. I can't imagine ever. I was to say, if you were in COVID and we were doing a lockdown or protest and you had masked Biden federal agents that shouldn't want to show their face. Well, they can't show their face because, then they'll be harassed. Well, good. They shouldn't be a federal agent if they can't take the heat. You cannot have a masked federal agent. I'm sorry. Anyway, I'm getting digressed because that is another big problem. And even Trump's admitted they've gone way too far on the ICE. And by the way, the Democrats have a bill to defund, abolish Department of Homeland Security. I'm all for that vote. I mean, I hated it when Bush Cheney started. Anyway, I'm digressing a lot here. But to answer your question, throughout history, they've always tried to come up with reasons why we can't be free, whether it's terrorism, war, pandemic, climate, illegal immigration. I'll even say that emergency power, then with some of the greatest abuses. They're never going to give up. I don't think climate's going to go away. I think there'll be a comeback at some point. And I think I'll be fighting the WHO pandemic treaties as they come forward with those. But right now, I mean, it could be AI. It could be our greatest battle. AI, censorship, and surveillance. And I guess surveillance is probably the most insidious because Trump administration seems to have a blind eye to that at the moment.
I fear, unfortunately, you are correct on all of that. And yes, it doesn't mean that this is over. But having said that, I mean, we need to, at the very least, be able to take victories as they come, to let our guard down, to not be naive about it, but at least to celebrate. After decades of seeing nothing but climate porn alarmism spilling across the news feeds, it's good to see something different for a change. And let's celebrate that. And anyway, I will allow the audience to go out there and celebrate it in their own way, hopefully by following Climate Depot. Tell us about your work there and how people can follow your work.
Yes. I go to all the UN summits. I've written 3 books, Politically Incorrect Guide to Climate Change, Green Fraud, and also The Great Reset, Global Elites, the Permanent Lockdown, which, by the way, Alex Jones actually said my book was better than his when I was on his show, meaning mine was more comprehensive, because he wrote a book on The Great Reset too, just as a side marketing plug. But I do that, and my website's climatedepot.com, op-eds, opinions, media, and I'm constantly meeting with the Trump administration, EPA officials on a regular basis, to just try to help any way we can. There's a whole group of us that meet with them. So we're doing everything we can. Last time around, Trump's first term, Biden had undone everything in probably 2 months. This time around, because of key congressional follow-up, like, for instance, getting rid of the gas-powered car ban, Congressional Review Act, the California waiver, they actually made that legislation. And Trump gets it when he's asked by people, what do you need to do next? He said, we need to get these executive orders turned into legislation. So that's what he wants Congress to focus on, because I can't cheer for any more executive orders. To me, it's like, that's done. Okay. You can do anything you want. Executive orders can be undone. So we got to move on from that. We need legislative action. And that's where the pulling out of the UN really makes it difficult. There's a permanence to Trump 2.0 on climate and energy. I'll just keep all the other issues out of it, but it's going very well in those areas.
Excellent. All right. Let's leave it there for now, but I hope we have more good news to talk about in the future. Mark Morano, climatedepot.com. Thanks for your time.
Thanks a lot, James. Appreciate it.
The Corbett Report is 100% listener supported. Join the Corbett Report community to become a member and log into CorbettReport.com to read the subscriber newsletter featuring my weekly editorial, recommended reading and viewing, discounts on Corbett Report merchandise, and once a month, a subscriber-exclusive video. Sign up today at corbettreport.com/members and help support this independent media.